Hello and welcome to Keyframes, a podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton, and with me today is Andy.
Hey, hey, hey.
Duncan.
Hello.
And Jeff.
Yellow.
It's been a while since I've had to do that introduction three times in a row. I hope you can detect the extra zest in my voice. Anyway.
At this point, it wasn't purposely done by Andy. It was just accidentally done by Andy.
I mean, is anything Andy does purposeful? Does he have qualia? I don't know.
Look, I'm just the beautiful manic pixie fairy who just manages to fuck everything up.
Well, speaking of beautiful manic pixie fairies, we're talking about anime this podcast episode. Surprise, surprise. We're doing the end of the winter 2026 season and the beginning of the spring 2026 season. We'll start with the former, you know, things move in chronological order. And to get it out of the way, I want to talk about a little show called Trigun Stargaze.
Oh, I've heard good things about it.
Andy says people like it.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but amazing things.
I followed people on Blue Sky specifically to like get opinions from people who liked it, and it turns out they're wrong. We can talk about that. Duncan, you also watched it, so please chime in.
I mean,
watched is a strong word, I know.
I hated it, but just with a less of fire than you.
So Trigun was my first anime, so it's inevitable that I really worried about having some sort of gatekeeping feeling here influencing. So I was really trying to like approach this anime for what it's trying to do and not criticize it for not doing things that the manga and the rebooted manga and the 90s anime did better. So this is the second season after Trigun Stampede, which ended up being a prequel to what we consider the mainline Trigun plot. But it's largely a reboot with the characters recast. We had the weird Robert De Niro character last season. The insurance girls are journalists now, which is much more boring.
Wait, did they get a job change or were they just...
No, they're just different characters.
Oh, well, right, okay.
They're the same people. They just have different jobs and it's just like roll with it. But yeah, this is like kind of a like Marvelized reimagining that I would say the main objective is to put more emphasis on the villain, Millions Knives, or Nye as they call him, for reasons that escape me, and like what his motivations are and what his plan is, like what he's trying to do, I think presumably to give more context to why Vash is trying to stop him, because apparently the difference between wanting to kill all humanity and wanting to kill all humanity to make a paradise for the plants you're cannibalizing to get the power to kill all humanity to make plants safe. It is meaningful. Do you want to talk, Duncan, or should I just continue to plow through my notes?
I have less issues with Trigun's lore than I do its general incoherence. Like, I just don't think it's a good, well-told story. The original and many of its contemporaries are villain of the week. And so you fight the villain, you see their quirk, the quirk poses some unique challenge to your protagonist, which they have to overcome. They either demonstrate something of their character or they grow as a result of it. I feel like very rarely did that happen in any of the encounters. It was just like, and we don't even get some good gun-fu most of the time. It's just mostly him running about.
You don't like Wolfwood and three-armed Wolfwood shooting at each other with their giant crosses for like half an hour?
One of the problems I had is like, and this is another bet noir of us, like we both had a lot of problems with G-Crux, and one of my particular biggest problem with it was the way that the fights just felt like, okay, you've got an environment which mainly exists for these 3D characters to bounce around off. It's just platforms for people to launch off and duck under. And it felt that way in Trigun as well. Things were just there. So, we can throw someone into it. It can crash down. It's
deathmatch levels.
Yeah, it's
PvP deathmatch levels.
It's not there because it's the world. It's there because it's just a platform to demonstrate moves on.
No, I don't disagree. It's weird how many fights happen in this massive void. And this is a desert planet, so you can have like cool fights in the desert, but they're never Man with No Name. They're always Ricochet for Half-Life 1. So I was kind of excited when we started this season because the idea of a fleet coming in and they don't know that there is a genocidal freakazoid on the planet who's planning to kill them. I thought that there was going to be, you know, factions and uniting, but instead they just keep shrinking the possibility space. Eventually humanity is only in this one city. And just like watching this like cool thing, this idea of like a rescue fleet that's coming to this desert planet full of fuckheads, and it becomes a trash mob for knives to kill. I think a lot about the Christian imagery, the Christian themes in Trigun that are so obvious here. Someone on Blue Sky talked about how the crisis of modern evangelical Christianity is that its adherents see every vice as a virtue if done in the name of God. And that's kind of the problem with Stargaze and Stampede, is that they have this idea that like bad things are bad unless you do them for a good reason. And it kind of complicates the show's ideas about pacifism. In the original manga and anime, pacifism is an act of choice, but not an ideology. You can't just believe in pacifism. Pacifism has to be in service of a goal. And because it's not an ideology, it can be perverted, like Knives. I'm thinking of Shishio Makoto from Rurouni Kenshin. These characters who know that, like, this is a principle that's not totalizing and therefore it can be abused in some way. To have it in Stampede and Stargaze be turned into an ideology, it becomes an ideology of passivity, of an action that Vash needs to be converted from. He needs to be turned from the guy who won't kill people into the guy who will kill people. And that exists so fragilely with the show's extreme reluctance to kill people. I was blown away when they started converting Gung-Ho Guns to the good guy side. One of the things I like about Trigun is the anti-apostle angle, that Knives has recruited these, you know, dozen or so assholes who are just there to make Vash's life miserable and make him reevaluate his beliefs. And every single one of them dies in the original anime. They don't exist as their own character. They exist as specific challenges to Vash's worldview and something that he has to go through. And so this idea that Vash needs to grow his ideology of care, or someone can just come along with a sledgehammer and smash it, is transformed into Vash needs to become the guy with the sledgehammer, that he's just wrong, rather than that he hasn't thought things through. And I think that kind of taps into how interested this show is with elements from the Christian Bible. Like I said, the Gung-Ho Guns are anti-apostles. Wolfwood is Vash's Peter, who, you know, lives by the sword and dies by the sword. Mm-hmm. But the execution is so flawed. When these fallen apostles are being redeemed, it would be like if one of the apostles fell to Satan, which I guess Judas did, but that was like the whole point of Christ's life, is that he knew. And eventually Satan himself is redeemed. Knives, like, revives the planet, and then they decide to leave it as a preserve, and Peter lives by the sword but does not die by the sword. He like shortens his life with those stupid fucking ampules, but all that means is he gets a hair color change.
I thought, you know, he's leveled up, he's got a hair change, you cut your hair.
Precisely and his three-armed little brother, his arm just falls off and he becomes normal.
Wait, what?
He becomes two-armed.
Where's the other arm?
It comes out of like a port in his back, and when he becomes good, when he like suppresses his like insane schizophrenic murder personality, like the arm just falls off.
Like a vestigial limb that is just like, oh, you.
Well, it melts into like nano ash. You know how these things look.
Amazing.
And then everyone just gets on ships and leaves the planet. They're like, okay, we're just gonna leave it to be a beautiful Eden.
Oh, they just fuck off.
Yeah, everyone leaves. Knives decides, everyone says, oh, Knives was just lonely, which is wild because he's surrounded by henchmen the entire fucking anime. I need to swear less. The entire fracking anime. And I think that that's the kernel of what the show is trying to say. Being an outrageous extremist ideologue is isolating and lonely, and like, we are better people when we're around people. But it's not really followed through. And the idea that this desert murder planet that's created just to make this sort of like pressure cooker for this one guy, and instead they just turn it into a garden and leave. They're gonna find another planet. I guess they're plentiful. So I don't know. I mean, I know why they landed on this planet, because Knives sabotaged the fleet and crashed all the ships and killed millions. But he died making some grass and trees. So he's cool, and we're just gonna like Just gonna leave it behind. I don't know. I could rant forever.
I imagine he looked hot doing it, so.
There was kind of a weird impreg thing. Like, he absorbed Vash, and then Vash popped out of his tummy, and they, like, talked a bit, and then Wolfwood said the Lord's Prayer, except not really, and then knives crashed into the ground, which killed him, but it did not kill his reborn brother baby Vash, who was born out of him.
People are mad for impreg these days.
What if men have baby? It's the question we have to ask over and over.
It's on everybody's lips. It's on everybody's lips.
Someone take the conversation away from me. I was so excited. I was so excited to have a Trigun reboot, and I was stupid to think so, and I feel bad.
Well, another thing that has probably a lot of MPreg fan art, Steel Ball Run.
I was really wondering what you're going to say.
Isn't that this season?
No, this was last season. It was one episode. People got really. It was so. Steel Ball Run is the seventh.
Yeah.
JoJo arc, and it is, I would say, one of the more beloved. After obviously 3, 4, in my opinion, 5. But it's up there with one of the best JoJo series.
Just name the whole fucking franchise.
Nah, I skip 1 and 2. And
no, 2 is the best one.
We don't talk about 6.
2 kicks ass.
2 does kick ass. I love 2. Anyway, right.
It's very weird, though. It's the weird one.
I swear this is the same conversation we have every time we talk about JoJo. They released a 45-minute OVA of Steel Ball Run, and it was good. It cut out a lot, and there was another character that they cut out a lot of, which makes sense because you don't want the 45-minute OVA of to focus on, like, and isn't really in the anime that much. It was as well animated as you have been getting from JoJo since Arc 4, which is reasonably decent, and then some areas which look pretty good.
That all sounds positive so far, Andy, but
they released one episode, and then I feel as an enjoyable throwback to the original ONAs, they were just like second episode's coming when it's coming, baby. So I really enjoyed the first episode. Gyro and Johnny are absolutely great. I'm looking forward to more. They've now announced that there's going to be a whole series in December, which is great news, but also potentially bad because it's probably going to be really shittily done. Whilst I was quite looking forward to the idea of an episode will happen when it happens, which was the original thing that Netflix was saying, which was just like, it's going to happen when it happens, baby. It's all going to be good. And nobody fucking liked that, not in this day and age. We'll
see. Yeah, they've trained people too much to just binge. And if you can't binge the whole thing, then why even live? Why even watch it?
It is purely a problem of that Netflix have created.
With that sort of thing, it is all about expectation. If you think it's going to be a single episode OVA, and you know or a episode 0, and you can get the series at a later point, people can handle that. That happened with Gundam Witch from Mercury. We got episode 0, and we knew this is coming now, and then in a couple of months' time, we'll actually get the series proper. But then with something like Strange Fate, it had an episode 0. And then it said, okay, now coming next year is episode 1. Then it broadcast episode 1, and it was like, okay, 3 seasons time, you get the rest of the season. And everyone went fucking berserk.
Yeah.
The episode 0 of Fate Strange Fake was constructed as a standalone bit of eye candy. It was introduce the setting, introduce the cast, do some pyrotechnic, And okay, everyone's hyped. Everyone's like, yeah, this is like a feature-length trailer. We're all hype now. But the episode 1 they put out was, okay, we are now in the location. We'll introduce the character and the plot starts to move and hard stop. And everyone's like, wait, what's next? Wait, you this was supposed to go on to something. With JoJo's, was it at a point where it was you could feel the next episode coming, or was it something where it was the prelude?
The story of Steel Ball Run is that in the new world that is created after season 6, there is now a race across the whole of America, and so that race is split into separate parts, And this first episode was the first part. So this was like the...
Oh, so it's like a leg. It's like a stage.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And yeah. I should also mention that, like, I feel that with JoJo, it is diminishing returns. And I think that the animation studio knows that as well, because season 6 was a dog. It was almost a fucking joke, which is a shame, because season 6 has some good characters. This one felt like it was a big step up.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it definitely felt like this is the end of, like, the first leg of the race.
Oh, that's good. Having a stage which you can actually make that cut on sounds like it,
yeah,
in some ways makes it far more natural than just, oh, this, we're just, yeah, arbitrary stopping now.
Yeah, they weren't squaring off to an enemy and then stopping. No, it was none of that. It was like, yeah, this is a reasonable place to end episode one. It was just a great OVA that made me realize why I like JoJo so much.
Mm.
Okay, well, speaking of great shows that make me realize why I like a genre or a subgenre or a sub-subgenre so much, I really liked You and I Are Polar Opposites.
Yes,
me too.
I found it refreshingly straightforward, even optimistic as a rom-com. I liked that the romance moved at the pace of life. Characters will think to themselves we're moving too fast, but it's the show really always depicts that as, like, that's coming from fear and insecurity. You're not right if you feel overwhelmed in a relationship. And whenever characters pull back, the response is almost always in romance anime, people pull back in response. And in this case, every single time when someone pulled back out of insecurity, the other partner stepped up. Yamada, the popular, like, the kind of vapid popular guy. That's mean to Yamada. He's just a
sweetheart
guy.
Yeah. I think they all have their, like, independent characteristics which you can sympathize. Like, Tyra's just constant joke of just being like,
no, he's black-pilled Tyra is me. I will say that until the end of time. Where he's just like, oh, like, he's the one who's constantly just running. He's like, oh, yeah, this, yeah, girl's thinking that. He thinks he's in a traditional rom-com where, like, everyone's in their head and, like, pushing people away out of insecurity. And
he felt really real to me. Like, Tyra feels the realest of all of the characters.
Yeah. No, I love him. He's still got all the insecurity and has just decided that, like, people are awful to you for no reason, and therefore it's to your advantage in every case to just make the most cynical reading of any social interaction. That he matched up with the girl who's like, yeah, I just date jerks. I don't know why. I just date jerks. And it's just like them getting attracted. That's my favorite. But I wanted to talk about Yamada and Nishi, the shy girl. Mm-hmm. Because when Nishi's like spiraling about, like, oh, he talks to so many women, he can't possibly be interested in me particularly. And he, like, sees that and he's like, yeah, I'm kind of overwhelmed with all the people I've been that we're being around. Let's go alone and talk together. And it's nice because I feel like in a regular rom-com, he would have been like, man, girls are weird. I don't understand what they're thinking. I better pull back and be less affectionate towards her. So, like, the emotional realism paired with what I think is a digitally stunning style with lots of, like, I mean, Jeff stole that, like, that why gif that I made of her bowling. It just goes straight into it. It's like, why?
Extremely relatable.
It feels very fresh. It drives home to me how much I'm used to putting up with anime romance that depends on people being oblivious to obvious emotional cues. Like, I like Ramparts of Ice, but Ramparts of Ice is a much more traditional take from this same author where it's just people just misunderstanding each other. And it's so nice to have a romance anime where people get each other and people want to be closer and people want to build a relationship and aren't like, do I deserve a relationship? Yes, you do. Everyone does. Even Tyra.
I really enjoyed it, and my big problem with the manga was specifically when, like, Tani and Suzuki, I just felt that their relationship plateaued in the manga for me. I felt that they didn't do a good job of expressing, well, I mean, that's kind of Tani's point, is that he doesn't really express his emotions well, but, like, I felt that the anime did a really good job of actually making that relationship less one-sided than I felt that was there in the manga, and actually, like, seeing the relationships on both sides. So I actually really recommend the anime because also it was about the time when it plateaus where they then start focusing on the other characters.
Yeah,
they
ran out of juice with the main romance. Yeah.
Like Taira, Nishi, Azuma, Yamada, who I love as well. Like, they're so good.
Yeah.
Tani and Suzuki, like, their relationship felt more real and more relatable and sort of like way more enjoyable than what I got out of the manga. I don't know how you felt about that, Jeff.
Yeah, I found the performance of the VA for Tani really sort of like he maintains that sort of classic like shonen romance affect, but was able to make him feel like an actual person who's sort of coming into the role of like being a boyfriend. And
for his whole life he's been praised for withholding his emotions, and now he's finally in a situation where like his girlfriend Suzuki, who is a dream girl, just like she's good
at a manic pixie dream girl.
That's me, baby.
My favorite thing is that she's good. Is like she's like not dumb. Like she's got good grades. That's a subversion that this author seems to do of like, oh, this vapid character is actually like good at school. They're just bad at emotional relationships. But yeah, she like the way that she like tries to like pull him out, and she takes the lead in the relationship as opposed to, again, like in any other romance anime, she would just stew in resentment that he won't kiss her. But she like takes the lead, like she kisses him and she's like, I want to do more of this. And he's like, oh, but I like him. I like him. In kind, it reminds me of Karikana, but mostly just because it is these like genuine personalities that really want to be together, and they're just the obstacles are their personality defects, and they need to overcome those, and they do it together, and that's what makes a great romance anime to me.
Can I kick this anime a bit before you praise it too much?
You're gonna call it contrived.
I mean, I'm gonna just say, like, when was their flaws not their gimmick? Like, when did someone have a flaw which was not what we expected? I'm not saying its execution wasn't very, very good, because it was very, very good. But I felt like every time we meet a character, you're introduced to them. And as you say, like, that they establish and they ground what they are. But it is obvious from the start what their flaw is going to be. And it doesn't feel like we really find a different side to that. They are what we expect them to be.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, but I would argue that the show is putting an emphasis on a different stage in character development, because in so much of romance anime, the getting to know a character is about figuring out what exactly their damage is, and Polar Opposites is not interested in that. It just tells you what their damage is, and then it lets you watch them grow in the context of a positive, supportive relationship. And so, like, I'm not saying that every romance anime should be like that, but it's nice to have one that's not just like, lol, will these damaged characters ever be able to acknowledge their feelings for each other? Like, we hop right into it and we move past the premise, as opposed to like dwelling on the premise, which there are great anime that are just like, it's hard when you're like stuck in your head as a kid to like know what someone who loves you for you will even look like. I think that this show is more interested in like, once they're past that point, what does a stable relationship between these flawed personalities look like? And I can understand that feels a little candy sweet, but
I preferred it towards the end, certainly.
It's less about quote unquote like fixing them, and more about accepting them for who they are.
Like if Taira and Azuma were the main perspective characters, and it was mostly them observing these other couples and complaining about them internally and not being able to figure out how to fix themselves and slowly overcoming it, like, it wouldn't be the same sort of candy sweet comedy at that point. It would be something closer to like Kimi ni Todoke. What?
Kimi ni Todoke.
Yes. I overthought it. God damn it.
Can I just ask, Duncan, do you like Ramparts of Ice?
I haven't watched it.
Oh.
Just give it a try.
Well, I think maybe you'd like it, because it's the same author but doing a much more traditional structure where
I haven't touched any Netflix shows this season.
So now I would be interested to know what you think of that, because I do think like the main character of Ramparts of Ice is so fucking damaged, just like an absolutely abused woman who just cannot accept that people are interested in her for her. And it will be interesting if you like this mangaka, their style, if you're just watching a show where, like, it's a bunch of fucked up people who really can't seem to connect or not.
I'm really enjoying Vampire Survivors. I think it's pretty good. It's interesting that it's a different thing, but you can definitely see the little roots that like blossomed into polar opposites.
Yeah, I'm glad.
I'm looking forward to her next series.
And plus we'll get more Tyrazima because they were just starting to like poke at each other. Yeah,
they are my favorite couple.
Same.
Yeah,
their constant, as you say, their constant fear of everything, it's delicious.
It's set off by the rest of the show, and it's the as a depressive nerdy weirdo, I like every relationship in high school and early college was like, why won't this girl leave me alone? And then like 2 weeks later, like, where is this girl? And then like 2 weeks later, I'm like, man, I really hope I can hang out with this girl. And then like 2 weeks later, I'm like, I guess I'm in love. that sort of thing. The gradual.
Yeah. Yeah. I found them the most relatable. Like of all the characters, the Tyra Azuma couple.
Cool.
Moving on to someone else that's relatable.
Speaking of relatable. Yes, Andy, you know my techniques. It's like we're one of those happy, stable couples in polar opposites where we don't, both of our flaws kind of complement each other.
We were both going to mention again another thing that had a date in it, which was, of course, Freerun Season 2.
Oh, I was going to say Journal of Witch, which is relatable.
Shit. Journal of Witch would have been good.
Journal of Witch is relatable.
Different witch.
No. Let's do Freerun. What do you guys actually have to say about Freerun? Except,
I love
more Freerun.
I love it.
I love it.
Tell me what. Tell me. I know it was good. It was great. But how was it great in any way which was different to the original series of Freerun? It just felt like more Freerun. It's extended Freerun.
That's what happens when you have a second season of the good show. You get more of the good show.
Change.
We can keep clowning on this, or I can answer your question. I mean, I liked moving into Northern Plateau. I liked the shift in culture that was reflected in architecture, that was reflected in how people treated like the economic networks, the growing like awareness of like demon. I'm putting culture in scare quotes, demon culture.
The people that they revered as heroes as well was really nice.
Yeah, no, the actually probably my favorite episode was the one about the guy who had future sight, and he was like, okay, I'm gonna like devote my life to setting up everything so that the next hero who comes along will kill the demon lord. And he's like forgotten, and it's beautiful and poignant. What Freerun is very good at is like every day feels like the same, and yet small moments will change history forever. That's the thesis of Freerun, and it's best encapsulated in that episode. But even just the Northern Plateau, I felt like we moved into a different country, which doesn't always happen in fantasy anime. Often it's like fantasy Germany, and then fantasy Germany with red flags, and then fantasy Germany with blue flags. And so it was just nice to like this weird kind of like starved culture that's still actively fighting like wars against, you know, demons and monsters. So I liked that a lot.
I really enjoyed the date that Fern and Stark went on. That was very enjoyable.
Oh yeah, that's cute. Yeah.
That was really cute. But I felt if I had any like minor sort of niggles about the show, it was that fight with that guy with like the six swords, and they're all like, I bet you he's got six swords, and we're like, and then he comes up, lo and behold, has six swords, and then they defeat him. But then Stark has like literally a hole in his chest that and then he still is managing to fight, and I'm just like, I mean, there's some like fantasy whatever bullshit that you're like, sure, but I feel that the kind of the beauty of Freerun is also the simplistic everyday like realism of it, and that fight kind of just pushed it a bit past.
I would argue against that, mostly in that I think it might have started as a joke, and then the mangaka got kind of trapped in it, where the dwarf warrior, why can't I remember his name now?
Aizen?
Yeah, Aizen. Aizen the dwarf, Stark's master.
Eisenhower.
They just kind of established that he is indestructible, and you know he's falling out of the sky, he's getting blasted by dragons, he's getting crushed and picking up mountains, and that's just like, oh, people are just durable. Like, if you're a warrior, yeah, like, you know, this is easy if you're a warrior. And
you train, you know, really hard. If you get a really hard body, you get a literal hard body. And that's...
But there's a difference between, like, a hard body and literally losing organs.
Yeah.
And still being able to fight.
It's just strictly within the logic of the world. Like, it's... These people are D&D, you know, 20th level D&D people who have, like, 500 hit points, and a goblin stabbing them in the chest means literally nothing because they are heroes. They just... They're just tougher. They're just... built differently. It's
I don't know, I'm not buying that.
Farther into the manga, they also start leaning in more into like warriors being similarly fantastical to wizards, and that they sort of start touching on that more towards, you know, where it's at now, which is unfortunately in an indefinite hiatus because of health concerns, which means we're not really going to get to that stuff for a long time.
I think I'm with Andy.
And there's also and there's also the fact that it's a similar, you know, problem with a lot of anime adaptations. You know, something goes from being like a single panel gag in a manga, and they have to stretch that out into a full fight scene. Like, I think in the manga, that was like the fight with the six-armed guy was like, you know, a few pages, whereas this was an entire episode. So you have to really sort of like, you have to worry more about the reality of the situation. You can't just...
This does feel a lot like the anime is stretching for time a little bit compared to how much manga they've got.
And sometimes it works. Like when they show Frieren's three-day tantrum, which is again like a one panel gag. And actually like stretching out like that, you know, then it works. But Stark having his head bitten by a dragon, is a one-panel gag that is never really remarked upon beyond, like, oh, it's scary how durable you are, but in that, you have to see him getting, like, flopped around like a dog with a chew toy, and it's like, yeah, you're like, it does kind of stretch believability, but it's like, you know, it's a joke, so I'm okay with it.
I think the big problem is that you have the world which Ben praises, this world of small events, of logistics, of villages which are lived in and have a purpose and a place within the world. And that is what you would sort of generically think of as sort of low fantasy. And then you have indestructible warriors and all-powerful mages, which is kind of high fantasy. And you kind of get this clash between what the characters are capable of and the world they exist in, which sometimes jars.
There's a tension in the like inherent structure. I know, I get that. I think I just had a realization. They don't have healing magic in this setting, do they?
Like, they do. No, they do.
But like regenerate a fucking limb healing magic? Yeah, or
they regenerated Stark's body organs, so definitely do.
Like, yeah. Implicit healing magic.
It's not usual because it's just like everything magic related. It is a lot of imagination of like what the internal body organs look like. But yes, they did use magic to heal Stark after that fight.
And I think you're probably going to have a whole bunch of priest magic stuff come up later again once they're finished with the warrior stuff they're doing now. But again, pure speculation. Don't know if we'll ever actually get it, which is unfortunate.
The other thing I was going to mention about Freeman is that I realized after watching Witch Hat Atelier is just like how consistent all the shots are. It's beautifully consistent and it's lovely. And I really, really love Freeman.
What do you mean by consistent?
Just the characters feel consistent and the animation feels consistent.
Do you mean it's on model?
It's not just on model, but it's also like... My problem with Witch Hat Atelier is that you know when they've put the money in for the shots, which is fine, but I just don't get that feeling from Freeman. But we're not here to talk about Witch Hat Atelier.
We will be later.
We're here to talk about a different witch.
Yes, we are.
One with a journal. A journal with witch.
Best thing this season. After, best new thing this season.
I think that is a fair assessment. Journal with Witch, an adaptation of a relatively short manga, which I would highly recommend going through reading.
Is it short when it's 11 volumes, and that is actually, that's the weird standards of manga, that that's a short thing. Like most yeah. Western graphic novels were like, oh, you've got a run of trade paperbacks out of your thing, you'd be like, fucking hell, I'm doing well.
The plot of Journal with Witch is Makio Kodai accidentally, sort of on a whim, adopts her dead sister's 16-year-old niece and is introduced to the fun world of parenting and caring about something other than yourself. And the teenager gets to learn that the rest of the world doesn't necessarily care as much about you as you do, and that you need to assert yourself on the world and have faith in that and grow as a human being. It is a very nice, very handsome adaptation, which I think unfortunately sort of pairs back a little bit of the comedy of the manga. Not quite to the degree that, say, Ghost in the Shell seriousifies into the movie from the manga, but like there is a little bit of like the levity that's missed, that kind of pokes through in the show with like the occasional goofy goofy facial expression, but as an expression of genuine pathos and grief and anxiety and pain and growth and love and support, I think it is a wonderful show. And it's an interesting showcase of, you're looking at a character and they're, you hear the way that they're describing themselves and you're like, is this an intentional decision to depict a neurodivergent character, or is this a neurodivergent mangaka who doesn't realize what they're doing, or is it just they're playing into tropes that happen to correspond with that? Because like, it's very, very easy to read Makio and Asa's friend.
Have you read any of her interviews around it?
I haven't.
So she's talked about, long story short, the mangaka started off her career doing stuff like Boy's Love. And as she sort of started to write stuff, stuff which was more sort of, as she grew as an author, she began to realize, like, okay, and she has said, be explicitly exposed to more Western media, she began to realize that some of the tropes in the genre she was used to working in were actually sort of harmful. She got woke, frankly. and woke brackets positive, and that she became aware that some of the tropes of the genres and some of the tropes found in like Japanese society and these kind of works were not helpful, and so she consciously made an effort to diversify her casts and to treat, like, one of her comments was she used the word homo a lot as between characters and as to sort of describe it's as two boys sort of like no homo, etc., and all that jazz. Right, she used slang, which was not helpful, and she made the decision, I have to actually treat these characters as people instead of just as a trope within this work. And I think you can see that she is trying to create these as people first, not as just a label. And one thing I've always tried to get across to people about things like the various neurodivergences is that you can think of them as like a recipe with a list of ingredients, but those ingredients go together in thousands of different ways. You can add the same ingredients but with different amounts, and they will produce an entirely different result, and that different result is a different person from another person with the same ingredients. And so when you look at someone like Makio, you can say, okay, she might be neurodivergent, but what's more important are the ingredients. It's her exhaustion around people. Like, I think one of the things is that we really value as a society is like choice and freedom. It's like one of the quintessential human qualities. But at times we sort of really fail to notice like how much we remove choice from our lives just to function. people need routines, they need habits, they need authority sometimes, if they're not to constantly exhaust themselves through choice. And I think, like, when you look at Asa and Makio, you see two people who have been sort of disconnected from sort of the norm of society in two very different ways. Asa's been completely unwillingly unmoored from this. Like, her parents mm-hmm. are gone, and all these people who society expects to be there, being her role models, giving her expectations which she can follow, are just gone. And she has to make every decision for herself. She has to, what class she takes, or what club she joins, all these things. What does she want to make of herself? There's no one there guiding her. And that instead, she's got Makio, this person who has stubbornly refused to provide any of that. Like, she just will not take any of these mundane choices away from Asa, because they were taking away from her in a way that she couldn't handle. And so she refuses to do those things for Asa, even though Asa deeply needs those things. She needs the routine. She needs someone to make a choice when she can't. It's really interesting of contrast between these. Oh, Asa, who wants all these things, and Makio, who, I think we get a sense by the end, does want some of these things as well, but resents the very sort of idea that she wants them. She doesn't want to see herself as dependent on other people. Like, very early on, we see her saying to someone, "I'm not her parent." Line in the sand. No, I'm putting my emotional boundaries down hard and fast. And by the end, we get sort of to see the loosening of that. Like, when her friend and Juno brings up that's explicitly, she's talking to her about, "One day Asa will move out of my life," and Juno's like, "These things aren't as clean as that."
Yeah.
That's the wonderful thing this about someone who has these self-imposed hard lines, sort of slowly redrawing them, and at the same time Asa finding out what lines she wants to draw for herself. And as you say, like, finding herself is a trite yeah. way of putting it, but still.
And yeah, like, Makio strikes me as somebody, like, she is, you know, she's 35 years old, which is like roughly 100 years older than most women are allowed to be in anime without being a tiny little, like, babushka doll. And it's well established that she is the adult who she wants to be, and it's kind of everybody else's responsibility to sort of accommodate her, because that's, you know, what she would expect from herself. She would not change for somebody else, or and she would not expect them to change. That's like kind of part of the inflexibility. It's less that she is being assertive of her own boundaries. It's that when she says, "I'm not Asa's parents," that is just a factual statement. To her, it's not like, "Oh, I've taken on this role." It is, "I am her aunt. I am going to give her support. I can't impose myself on her as being a parent. I can't." To her, it would be an unbearable
imposition.
An unbearable imposition to tell this grieving young woman, "I am now your parent, and you have to do what I say, you have to live as I tell you to live." She doesn't feel she has a right to do that. Mm. And so it's less that she is asserting her own emotional boundaries as much as she is trying to respect Asa's, as she would expect others to respect herself, which, and as you were saying, but that's not what Asa feels she needs. Like, she lacks like an empathetic connection to her, partly because, you know, she is effectively a stranger. She's hardly been in this child's life, but also in other shows, like, if this is a show about autism, which I don't think it is, then that would be like, "Oh, this is a challenge for Makio to overcome, and she will be fixed once she realizes that this is being cruel to Asa." I don't think the show is doing that. It's because, you know, in that case, you know, even subconsciously, you'd be depicting Makio's character as being negative, as being broken and needing fixing, which this show is not doing. That is just her personality, and I think it's treated in a way where she is, like you were saying, like, she is treated like a real person, and she's not treated as a collection of problems to solve. And Asa being, you know, going through this grief, going through this process, coming into her own, having her, like, you know, her preconceptions of, "I'm not the kind of person who does this. I'm not the kind of person who does that." Having the adults in her life tell her that, "I understand how you feel this way. I'm here to tell you that that is fake. Like, you are not locked into this thing that you think you're locked into. And we're sorry we can't be your actual parents here, because your actual parents were her father was completely disengaged. Her mother didn't know how to communicate with her daughter in a way that that was effective. And, you know, she tried to write a journal, but Asa rejected that as being, you know, I can't even trust this. Like, I don't know. People can write anything.
That's interesting that you say that about his her parents, Jeff, because I felt that that was purely someone's opinion of how their the parenting would be like. Because when you do see her the parents, the small snippets of the parents from Asa's side, they do seem like functional characters that are treating and caring for their loving, like they do love their child and they are looking after her.
I mean, yes, it wasn't always the caring she wanted though. Like they play that her getting her hair cut short and just like the brutally cutting remark that her mother makes, and she turns to her father and he's like, I don't have an opinion about this. And yeah, like, so she, they were loving, but they didn't show up for her in the way that she necessarily needed, which is why she's so suspicious of this journal that purports to like give her insight into her mother, who she spends the whole season struggling to figure out, like, what's like, how should I feel about this woman who birthed me and clearly wanted things for me, and yet I don't think she knew me in any way that she could have carried forward.
No, that's a fair point. I found the whole show exceptionally beautiful as a sort of a view on loss and a view on the sudden departure of major parents that isn't treated in a traditional shonen protagonist way of fighting.
Just imagine Asa, sword in hand, I will I will avenge my parents.
Yeah, the best episode is the episode where everything starts falling apart and then you like it starts becoming jumbled, cut up scenes purposefully, but then you can still make the through line throughout all of that. That was the best episode of the whole season.
I've been thinking a lot about adaptations this season, and because I've read ahead with Journal of Witch and finished it, it's sort of notable, like this covers, like, I'd say maybe the first third of the manga thematically, but there's content from it which is sort of further along, and it's clearly that they've made a decision here that there's this early theme around that loss and how the relationship is in its early stages, and they've decided to focus on that. The manga itself goes on to explore other things. We Asa decides to go and basically, she puts it herself, she's going to be a detective about her parents. She goes off and tries to track down some of her dad's former co-workers and other things. It expands quite significantly on those, and we find out different things about her mum and her dad, which quite significantly changed the way I viewed them, at least, and changed the way Asa viewed them as well. But this show has made the decision that that's not what it's about. I very much felt like something which knew it only had a single season to do what it had. It didn't feel like something which ever was in a place where it was like, oh, we're going to be able to get a second season, we're going to be able to do more. Because it was never rushing. It was almost a very slow-paced show. Despite actually shooting through the material, it never felt like that.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't read the manga, so I can't comment on all of this. Mm-hmm. But I do feel that the biggest problems with the show is one kind of plain and boring direction throughout, which is purely because of the budget that they don't have. So they're doing a lot with not a lot of budget, which is great. But number two, more importantly, was I do feel that some of the characters, especially the woman who be a doctor but then found out that there was like some big scandal in a university. Like, that whole story felt, given the pacing of the previous, like, events that have happened in this show, it felt it was resolved very quickly and not very satisfyingly either, which is a shame. But, like you said, like, the rest is beautiful.
The events surrounding Chio, who's the student who wants to go on to medical university, kind of happen over the first 2 years in the manga, mostly, and this season just compresses the first. The story diverges more as it goes along. It is not as focused as it is in these initial stages.
I really hope there's a second season. I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's going to be like a real push to get a second season out. But I hope that there's more.
You can always read the manga.
Yeah, I'll read the manga, definitely. I'll check it out. Like, the manga's still there. Yeah. It's just a shame, like, because it was such a unique show.
I feel I've talked like a lot. Do you have something, Ben?
No, I'd be retreading y'all's ground. We've discussed this plenty. We even answered the question that that one of our listeners sent in about how they felt that we characterized Makio to some extent as being saved by being forced to open up to Asa, and I think we addressed that thoroughly. So
I don't think I've watched anything.
I don't have anything else left. I mean, Medalist was great. Freerun's great. I think you want to talk about Torture Princess, which I guess I can open for. I mean,
if you're complaining about Freerun not being different, like Torture Princess is exactly the same.
I mean, it is a bit more extreme, and like Duncan mentioned, one of the final episodes where they all get like magically transformed to like ironic forms according to their wish, and like whether or not that was good, the person who got transformed into a motorcycle doing like the da rum 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 da 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 rum, and then she like stopped to like say her lines and then pick up again. It was goofy and fun. The further we get away from the torture conceit, and the more that it's just like a normal society, except that there are monsters and magic, and it's run by an extremely, like, God, the Demon Lord is such a loser. Like, I feel is meant to be more of a joke than it actually is for me, that he's just the most pathetic wife guy and, like, needy weirdo in the show.
I've got so much time for that guy. He's so funny. Every time he comes on, just, yeah, he tends to be a wife guy. I'm like, yes, this guy. This guy knows what he's doing.
Or like when he's going to like give a speech and they drive by a McDonald's and his like pig like major domo is like, do you want to have some food? And he's like, no, I'm too nervous. And then they get there and he's like, shit, I actually do want food. And so he uses his superpowers to run and get McDonald's and run back in time for his speech. And that's the level of humor with Torture Princess.
I did enjoy that. It just basically recognized it got the best it could out of its core joke and instead like shifted the emphasis onto that sort of wider cast and slice of life stuff. Yeah. And like at its core, it was always just about like, wouldn't it just be nice to goof off more and just to relax instead of having to do your work? And I feel like it leaned hard into that this season. I've got the main thing I'm going to talk about, but I wanted to breathe between that and the Journal and the Witch. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like I get to.
Sorry. Gotta go.
What is it? Is it anything anybody else has?
No.
Yeah. Is it a cruel fate?
It's Oshinoko. He wants to,
Oshinoko. Oh. Well, yeah.
Very quickly. Oshinoko was visually excellent again, and actually resolved some of the bigger questions. I love that it sort of retained a sense of humor amidst all its characters as breakdowns and breakups. Like sometimes these, I think the big thing for me for any melodramatic series, whether I can tolerate it or not, is does it actually have a sense of humor about it as well? Oshinoko does. Despite being a very melodramatic show, it can also take the piss out of itself, and so I am able to enjoy it more than I think I can others. And it's now winding its way to what looks like to be a final season where it's getting progressively more and more turned in on itself in terms of its plot structure. And I feel like the fans are absolutely going to hate where it feels like it's going. And so...
Yeah, people hate the ending of Oshinoko. They really loathe it.
It looks like they are very much... that the finale is essentially going to be them in universe, as it were, making a show which... resembles Oshinoko.
Not the first time that's been done.
Yeah, but it is going to be a bit strange. But it will. I have no doubt it will continue to look good and have the best banger of a soundtrack as it did. Medalist, as Ben said, great again. Kind of disappointed that it ended at the point it did. It
felt short. I mean, it was only 9 episodes, so I think they just adapted what they could adapt. So
yeah, it was that in the opposition to John, which very much felt like it just we're going to just end at this point, regardless of whether it's a satisfying conclusion or not. Fate Strange Fake, I enjoyed it hugely. Kept throwing surprises at me. Ended with a couple of huge twists, but ones which were very well set up and consistent with everything that which went before, which is about all you can ask for in that kind of show. But there was another show which
I watched and tried to railroad people into watching, which Jeff also watched a little bit of, and that was Shibuyugi playing death games to put food on the table. And one of the rarest things I find in any season is to find two shows which are very different but really enhance the understanding of each other. And for me, like, I really got a lot out of this, partly because Journal with Witch helped me think about it in a different way. Because Journal with Witch, as we've said, is a wonderful story, like, enhanced by vocal talent and very subtle but not flashy direction. While it is refocused away from the manga's largest themes to make sure it comes to a conclusion, it is just a adaptation. But when does adaptation become evolution? Like, when does something become an entirely different thing to what it's adapted from? Because I think Shibuyugi is an extremely rare case where it is just a completely different thing to its source material. To go to something which seems to inform a lot of things I'm thinking about at the moment, I've been back reading Dreadnought, and, like...
As you do.
Which is a wonderful, wonderful history book, which recommended to me by Ben. And it's made me think again about the absolute rarity of a definitive version of events and the absolute compulsion of humans to try and find one. And I think writing a good history requires sort of reconciliation of those contradictions. But I think writing a great history requires more on top of that. Like, you have a skeleton of event. On top of that, you build a greater structure. And you get many a metaphorical iguanodon built by someone who reassembles their dinosaur in the wrong way. But sometimes you'll get someone who, when they get it right, it will speak to you on the terms of its participants in the mundanity of their lives. It is such a melodramatic premise, like these death games that our protagonist Yuki is having to make her way through. And me and Jeff sort of discussed last time, like, how these are very arcane things with set rules and set expectations. And that could have been the focus of the show, but it is a show where we don't need to know the exact layout of every room. We don't need to know where the mechanics behind every trap. But those things are still, because they were in the original text, because they are part of the skeleton of this work, someone still needs to be aware of them. And their art director basically rendered all the environments in 3D. They were used as reference for the animators for their work. It took what was quite placeless and sort of ambiguous set of threat things and made it into a more concrete thing they could ground upon. It's a fascinating show from production standpoint, and Sakuga Blog has one of their, like, typically thorough breakdowns of this, which will be linked, and goes into its staffing and their choices. But the sort of typically sparkling eyes of the anime girls are actually created from the composite sort of gems. Andy would call this extremely pretentious, and I probably would not disagree with him. But it also does look different to anything I've ever seen before, and it is strange and it is different. Trying to sum it up more, like, the best I've really been able to come with, like, is that the dominant aesthetic of Shibuyugi is sort of an impressionistic CCTV. It's all these long shots from strange angles, but with the girls themselves rendered as, like, these almost abstract shapes within it. All colour, no lines, like, isolated, depersonalised in this massive concrete landscapes often. And it, like, really adds a sense that these characters are just, like, passing through. Like, they're not fixtures in the life of our protagonist, Yuki. What we're told throughout it is that she's seen by everyone else as kind of emotionless, unknowable, but what's made clear as it goes on is that she's aware of those qualities as also expressing a lacking in herself. She feels like she is missing something, and she actually has a certain jealousy towards the motivations that drives everyone else, because she's just sort of like being carried through this on just momentum and inertia. And the show's finale is basically the fact that she does have some empathy towards towards those she encounters, in contrast to someone who really doesn't remember those she kills, who really doesn't have regrets, who really doesn't prioritize survival, someone who is what everyone thinks Yuki is. And it's a climactic moment of self-reflection and processing of who she is. It's all told in a way that at times moves away from linear storytelling. We're put there and we observe, and we're left to sort of draw our own conclusions on what is present or absent from Yuki in that moment, and from there to draw our own implications of what the effect an event has had on her. We see her in one state, we see her in another state. What's changed? That's a decision we have to make rather than the anime will tell us. It initially just seemed like it was aesthetically very singular, but I do feel like it is probably one of the most singular shows I've bumped into since back in the good old Flower of Evil days. Which once again goes to my sort of deep conviction that Andy would absolutely hate it more than anything else I can imagine.
Yeah, I imagine I probably would.
Do we want to take a quick break and then hop into what our faves are from this current season? And we're back. Now it's time for the spring season. We're going to all focus on one show we really like so that we're not just talking about the 18,000 shows that we're watching, because there's just infinite anime these days. And Jeff, do you want to take it away?
Sure. The show that I am the most intrigued by this season is Even a Replica Can Fall in Love. Something that I have not seen hype very much at all. I saw somebody mention it on Blue Sky, checked it out, and I was like, It is, you know, derogatory to everybody else, but to me, a very Franxable show, complimentary. The premise is cool in that it is one of those magical realism stories where just a thing that is impossible happens, and then the rest of the story is just kind of dealing with that. Mm-hmm. In this world, Tsunao Aikawa, she, as a 7-year-old, gets into a fight with one of her friends, and she is too embarrassed and ashamed to make up with this friend, but she also wants to be friends with her again. And in this moment of crisis, she ends up creating, out of magic, out of thin air, a replica of herself. This replica has all of her memories, and feels a intense personal loyalty to Nao. And so she says, "Can you please go talk to this girl and tell her that I want to be friends again?" And the replica goes off and does this for her and comes back, and she says, "Thank you, now you can go away." And the replica vanishes. Nao has no memories of what the replica does, but the replica, every time she is called into existence, does have all of Nao's memories.
Wait, so is this set in, like, modern day, or is this...
Yeah, it's magical realism, basically.
Yeah, it's pure... Okay. It's okay. I described it in the chat as Murakami-esque, in perhaps kind of a... Like, Murakami-ish? You know, yeah. Maybe in a Boss Baby kind of way. You know, guy who's only seen Boss Baby, but that kind of magical realism where it is a modern world, there are no other fantastical elements of it except for this one very...
There's no wacky scientist sub-character who's like, "I've made a cloning machine anyway."
Yeah, yeah, there's no explanation to how, like, where the clone came from. There's some basic rules established where, like, you know, when the clone comes in, or when the replica appears, she's wearing the same clothing that Tsunoa was wearing when she called her. Anything she puts on after that drops onto the floor. The replica has all of Nao's memories up to that point, but the reverse is not, it's not the same. She does not know what the replica has done.
Right, okay.
And the main perspective character of the show is the replica. She starts going to school more and more in Nao's place, who in turn just kind of rots in her room in an almost hikikomori way until she just becomes overcome with shame and anxiety and dismisses the replica, and then starts going to school again until things get too hard for her again. And then she calls the replica back in to like take tests for her or to make up with her friends. And she is caught in this cycle where she has no ability to engage with any of the difficult parts of her life. And she demonstrates what going around in people talking about AI psychosis of like cognitive surrender, where she doesn't ever have to deal with any of these hard problems. She can just call this replica and it'll do it for her. And, you know, the replica starts building her own life. She starts making friends with people that now is not friends with. And she starts striking up a romance with a boy who, you know, at first is, you know, somewhat confused by the hot and cold reception that he gets when, you know, it's either now or the replica. He has no idea which is which until the replica, you know, starts asserting her own personality. You know, she says, you know, if I have my hair up, you know, in a half ponytail, that means I'm in the mood to talk. Otherwise, don't approach me. You know, and it seems like it's going to very quickly run into difficulties. And there's this lots of interesting sort of meat to chew on.
So did you watch the most recent series of Bunny Senpai, Jeff?
I did not.
Okay. I suspect to me and Ben, this is feeling like quite familiar ground.
It's feeling like multiple things. Like I have four comments, one after another. First, you should watch Migito Dali. I'm glad I watched it. I think you would lose your shit at Migi and Dali. Second, I have been haunted since childhood. I read Children's Book of Virtues, and there's a story of a kid who gets a magic glass ball with golden string inside, and he discovers that every time he pulls it, it skips a little of his life. And it's honestly a psychological horror. They change it to have a happy ending in the cartoons, but in the book, like, he pulls it and he realizes like he's skipped most of his life just by every time like, oh, there's a boring test, pull the string, it skips ahead to the end of the test. And he's like, oh, I'm having like a tough time at work, I'm gonna pull it to like skip until like work gets better. In the cartoon, he like crushes the ball and he like wakes up and he's a kid again and he gets to live his whole life all the way through. But in the book version, he just like ends like realizing that he's just like pissed away his life because he didn't want to have to deal with anything hard. And I'm constantly haunted by that story. It's probably one of the more formative things I ever read at like age 7 or something. But
yeah, that's serious trauma for a 7-year-old.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've always been very conscious of the fact that I will die someday. Like, I realized very much earlier than a lot of my other kids, and it's probably why I have major depressive disorder. But who knows? Maybe I'm just normal. Maybe this is how everyone feels, right? It's funny because I remember reading the Anime News Network previews, and one thing that everyone agreed is there's only one way for this to end, which is the two girls reintegrate. The Children's Book of Virtue suggests to me that maybe not. Maybe this will get even more like weirder and sadder and more impossible. And it makes me kind of want to hop on, especially if you continue to enjoy it, Jeff. And fourth comment, man, it must be weird to be like someone who just like peripherally knows Noah and she just has her personality change all the time. Mm-hmm. There would be a very funny chibi comedy spinoff series of someone who just is like kind of a casual friend with her, watching her personality change. I'm just thinking about that a lot because Girls in Panzer has this chibi comedy series that I'm like really enjoying. It's the funniest thing I've watched in years.
Does anybody else have the similar thing, Jeff, with this like?
Oh man, that'd be cool.
Not so far. I'm only about 3 episodes in. Maybe it's a whole thing. Maybe there's an entire expanded world and deep lore of the replicas, and I'm going to be very sad in a very Franks-like way.
<He's so disappointing>.
But like I said, this is a very Franksable show where I can get really excited about something that's not going to happen.
it's a good premise though, because it is the temptation to skip the hard parts of life is, I think, something that's relatively underexplored, or at least without a like very explicit moral framework, and this like split, this double self, does. Like, it's interesting that the other one like takes Nao's orders. It's like lets herself be sent to school and is not like, no, I don't feel like going to school today. You go to school. Mm-hmm. So
and it seems like at the beginning of the series, this is when the replica starts to assert herself as a separate person and the complications that they're going to arise from that. So yeah, I'm excited to see where it goes.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. Thanks for sharing.
Well, I guess moving on to something where I'm kind of less excited where it goes. Actually, that's not
you sound so bummed. My God.
Yeah. Akane Banashi has been my favorite manga for years now.
I remember.
And
yeah.
I am slightly disappointed with the anime adaption. As much as I love the manga, I just feel that this isn't reaching the highs that the manga is capable of. And it could just be that it's a bit of a slow burn, but I am just not that impressed with the show. I mean, I did cry in the first episode, but that's also because...
The first episode's intense. It's a whole anime on its own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the anime about a rakugoer called Akane, who's a child. Her dad gets abolished by Isho and is told to never be a rakugoer ever again, which, as far as the real world law goes, that isn't true. Like, you can't abolish, like, students.
I mean, it's shonen logic.
Yeah, it's just shonen logic, yeah. That is the only thing that it crosses the line on. The rest, it's pretty straight as to what it is like to be a rakugoer. Like your Chihaya Furus, it is a very intensely Japanese art form that is explored, and you have the edutainment factor of learning and also seeing rakugo. I'll be interested to know what, Ben, your feeling is on this, because I obviously have like read the manga, so I feel like a lot of the stories and a lot of the plot beats that they're going through has slightly been ruined for me. Yeah. I also think I misremember the beginning, because I feel that this expulsion of her dad, my recollection of the manga, and it could be that it comes up later, but that is like a turning point in the history of rakugo, which then has bolstered its popularity massively. Now, they don't mention that in the manga, in the anime, and Mids was also like, no, I don't think that's a thing. I think you've made that up in your head, Andy. And I was like, fair enough. Maybe I have.
I can't speak to that, unfortunately.
I'm not saying this has never happened, Andy.
Yeah,
but...
yeah.
Andy, I love your vivid imagination. And often you extrapolate bigger stakes than actually exist in a show. And I like that. I think it's actually one of the best parts of our podcast. But it does mean that sometimes you're like, oh, no, he told her to go fuck off and die. And we're like, no, he said go away. And you're like, no, no. No, he like, no, like, he like deleted her from existence. And I'm just like, look, okay.
I enjoy
the vividness. I enjoy the vividness. And I'll kind of, Banashi seems like a show that really rewards vividness. And it's kind of why I loved the first episode. I felt like I was like having a mental breakdown while watching it. It's so intense and so like, yeah. oh, this is one of his best performances. And the guy's like, no, you're never doing rakugo again. You're fired forever. Go become a broken man and just
become
stop existing.
Construction man.
It is what you usually, how you read like the big emotional moments. But then just like, we're not talking about Witch Hat Atelier because no one chose it as their favorite because we're a bunch of stupid adults. But it's that way too, of just like the Naruto-ness of it. And I'm not pretentious enough to be like, fuck Naruto. Like, Naruto rules.
Yeah.
At least like the premise it sets up and the big things that happen before it just becomes a forever show. But just like when I can see the Matrix, especially with shonen shows, like my interest just drops like a stone. And I don't like Akane very much. I don't feel like I know her outside of her determination to become her dad, which is a weird thing to... It's weird. Isn't it weird? Am I wrong? Is her dream to revenge her father with this old man? Like, I'd rather her just, like, buy a gun and shoot him. Like, I don't get the...
That's I Am Hero. I'm pretty sure that's I Am Hero.
Like, I enjoy it, and it made me watch Showa Rakugo, at least the first episode, which I liked a lot. It just made the shonen-ness of Akane Banashi feel really hollow, because Showa Rakugo is just this profoundly, like, weighty drama where, like, people are making, like, life-changing decisions. Besides just, like, loving her dad, I don't really know what it... Like, there's even suggestion that she doesn't really, like, love Rakugo stories yet. I think that's a part of her character development.
Yeah.
I don't feel she loves Rakugo. I think she wants to take revenge on her dad, and she should just put some nails in a baseball bat and find this guy on the street.
I think that, like, her intention was to beat Isho with her dad's Rakugo to prove that her dad is the ultimate Rakugoer. Now, I should also... premise this with, like, yes, I'm glad that you can see the Matrix, because you seeing the Matrix is what's going to impress you about the show later on.
Okay, good. That's comforting.
It just feels like it's taking its fucking time.
We don't need her to learn that she needs to tailor her stories to the audience. Like, no shit. Did she not realize that over the whole past, like, decade?
Well, no, she hasn't, because she's only done internal stories with her master.
I do love the Rakugo stories, though.
Yeah.
I genuinely, like, laughed, a, like, thick, rich laugh at the, like, the spur-of-the-moment joke. My encounters with Rakugo have largely been through Joshiraku, and in the Designer Zetsuba Sensei manga, there's a whole chapter on Rakugo where they tell, like, pathetic otaku versions of classic Rakugo stories. It's one of the best chapters of Siren Zetsuba Sensei, where the Fujoshi princess sneaks out and reads, like, boy's love, and then asks for manga, and she's like, oh, this isn't like the manga they make in so-and-so, and it's Japan's love of long stories where the punchline just comes at the end, and you're like, oh yeah, haha. I love that traditionalness, and so I think that the Rakugo will carry me through Akane Banashi, in a way that my love of fantasy tropes and magic will not carry me through Witch Hat Atelier.
Yeah, for a manga that's in 200 odd chapters now and is still going, the anime needs to speed the fuck up, because it is taking its time on those opening bits, and it is a bit boring. And it's one of those things in which I'm like, cool, I like that she's and she's like loving Rakugo, but that was also a surprise to me, being a fan of the manga. I was just like, I thought she always liked it. I feel like there's some weird stuff going on in there. But when you get more of the characters that come in, like Hikaru and Karashi, if they don't nail Hikaru and Karashi, I'll be really disappointed. And I feel that if it's going to end where I think it's going to end, I really loved that ending. I'm hoping that they nail those events that are coming up. Mm. But I am disappointed by the show.
It's a little dull. It's a little dull.
It's a
and
little
I didn't
dull.
Expect it to be. The first episode is buck wild, and so I'm surprised at how dull the last few
yes, it doesn't need to be
been.
That dull. They could have sped through some of those, like, the fucking, like, cafe chapter they could have sped through. But I guess it's that thing of them trying to show the dullness of repetitiveness of a Rakugo.
Maybe.
Like,
I think also the internet will kill them if they don't adapt everything.
Yeah, I was going to say, are you sure it's just not publisher pressure? Like, this does seem like a notable thing.
Publisher or fandom pressure, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It could be, but even then, like, they could have adapted, like, the fucking, like, cafe story they could have done in half an episode, where they're just like, I think the other disappointment that you're not getting is that in the manga, and I'm hoping that they're going to blow up into this and it's going to be something more like in the opening when she's walking through the world and she's like listening to her headphones and then she realizes she's in like old style Edo Japan and everything's really like differently, like hand drawn, like ukiyo-e painting style in the opening animation, which is insane. Like, the opening animation is mad because it gives her like some fucking Jujutsu Kaisen, like, world-changing powers where she could just blast everybody into the past.
They know they've got a great design in that character. Like,
it's such a good... It's a great design. And in the manga, they have this really nice considered thing where when they go into the stories and they tell the story in whole, or at least maybe slightly abridged, you see characters drawn in a Rakugo, in like an ukiyo-e style, which is usually stylized behind the characters. And it's usually like this whole world that you're seeing behind them. And then they're like acting the characters whilst they're positioned like either side of the Rakugoa. Now, what they have decided to do instead is to implement this sort of like sliding screen style thing where you see a part of the story as a single frame in a picture. And it just doesn't work as well. Like, the thing that captivates you when that gets maybe a bit quote-unquote dull in the manga is the beautiful art style that they've got for the stories, which they're just not showing. And it is a big disappointment in my eyes. I'm really hoping that when it gets going and Akane like levels up her abilities, I really hope that they change that, because there's some scenes in the manga which are absolutely incredible, and I really hope that they do it justice. And maybe they're building up to it with this weird sort of like screen style that they've got on.
Yeah, I forget. Did you ever watch C-3PO? That's got some nice scenes where the it's the like airsoft anime.
I know it. Yeah.
She like dissociates into being like a Fujiwara archer in like the 11th century, and that shifts into like woodblock style in a very, very lovely way. And I was just thinking about, yeah, it's that's too bad. I mean, y'all probably wonder, but like a reason I don't watch anime is the reason why I don't watch anime is because I'm a dumb moron. No, the reason I don't read manga a lot of the time is because so often y'all are so disappointed when you see an adaptation fall short. And I want to be able, as I'm recording an anime podcast, I want to be able to come fresh. And there are, if I love something a lot, I get the manga. I have Evangelion's manga. I have I read all Trigun's manga and then sold it because it wasn't worth rereading. I have all of Sayonara Zetsuba Sensei. And I've thought about getting the Turn A manga, which I hear is very good. But those are all like, well, except for Sayonara Zetsuba Sensei, those are like adaptations of the anime. So it's interesting because my impression of Akane Banashi is just that it has a fire hose of money pointed at it. And unfortunately, that can often turn out to be like not very like artful in particular. If I were to make a really good transition, I can talk about Kamina Botan Blossoms When Drunk, which is, I think, Duncan, please jump in, but I feel is a very modest budget. And so much of the art are these uncleaned up lines. And even in the third episode, which I love, speaking of Sayonara Zetsuba Sensei, they have all these like, you know, still title cards with text, and like it's very the restrainedness. It just takes a different skill set than what it takes to like make a visually attractive anime, because like the motion and stillness in Kamina Botan especially, which really well mirrors like the process of enjoying alcohol, because this is an anime about a dorm room full of potentially lesbian girls.
It's the Yui show.
There's our episode title, unless it's not.
I mean, its Japanese title literally has Yuri in it, so.
Sure, but so does Yurikuma Arashi, and they're just bears.
Yeah.
I feel like there's two types of Yui shows, though. Like, there's one which is the...
There are two Yuris inside of you.
One's a bear, and one's a blossom.
To me, it's the ancillary cast around the central relationship, because one of them is just like everybody's a girl, and so really what you're like, there's no men involved, and so really what you're looking at is you're just looking at
the K-on.
Okay, yeah, right, and then you've got the other ones in which there are mixed genders, and it is just the fact that these two girls happen to fall in love with each other.
Yeah. This is a dorm that's only girls. The world is like five girls and everyone else's extras, and they all love to drink, and they all are insecure, and I don't know. I remember that you were slightly down on Do It Yourself, but this is the Do It Yourself team coming back and doing like a watercolor Yuri, and I like it a lot, honestly. I think it's very interested in like how it feels to be around another person. It's mediated through alcohol, but just like so much of the anime is just like when you're sitting there looking at someone and you're just like, she looks pretty, she looks tired, she looks anxious, what's going on, what should I say? And the way that these girls always deflect those that train of thought into just being like, let's do an info dump on absinthe for a minute and 30 seconds. Like I dig it. Like, I think the only good alcohol anime, well, I like The Old Bartender, but it's not good. I like the Komada, the whiskey family, but that's more anime about like what it is to choose a career, and it just happens to be that they're talking about Japanese whiskey while they have that conversation. But this really is about like how you can channel your lust into like subsidiary topics and yet still become closer to a person, which I'm sure for a certain mental neuro makeup is really attractive, and I really like Kamina Botan. I was worried it would be a disappointment. I was worried it would be just like Yuri bait. It felt like it was just going to be like bait, and it's not.
I am amused that like when I first was watching this, I actually made a do-it-yourself comparison to you visually, and like sort of a is that does this just mean I've actually developed a palette to the extent I can actually distinguish an artist's work, or does it just mean that that work is just so different from the majority of shit out there that it stands out? And I think it might be the latter, because like, boy oh boy, by episode 3 it has really diverged. Like
episode 3, holy shit. Yeah, I want to see the ANN like power ranking and just watch that episode just spike the fucking no one's watching it is the actual truth, so it won't matter. But
it's got a rating of 3 on AnyDB at the moment. It's people do not like
what actually, what I'm going to look at my anime list. My anime list speaks to the people. On my anime list, it's got a perfectly average score.
Is the animation just not good then? Is it just...
Or
is
it's
just
beautiful. It's style? Fucking beautiful.
Right. Okay. Weird.
It's gorgeous. It's sketchy. It's got like a very like watercolor-centric palette. It's often like... attracted to stillness and like kind of landscapes that so that you are taking in what the characters are taking in when they go to the hot springs, and they're honestly the most beautiful hot springs I've seen in my life. My heart stopped seeing that episode. Like just a triangle shaped pool opening out onto the ocean, and you're just like looking over.
It does look like a very good day out, and that's something that it does throughout.
And you're drinking BrewDog. No, you're not. Yeah. Not this episode.
What happened to episode 3 then?
Like, they listened to some jazz while drinking BrewDog IPAs. It was sake. They had a carryout bottle of sake for their hot springs. There was the gif of like, I want to drink, 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 that was coming when they got the bottle of sake. But overall, it was a... I just like it. It feels very real. These girls are cool, and like they're dumb and shallow because they're meant to be like objects of desire between each other as opposed to between the audience and them.
Botan feels a very lively show.
Yes.
And like I really appreciate that sort of freshness and liveliness to its animation. Like it has an immediacy to it that like more carefully crafted stuff can miss. And I appreciate it is also quite pun heavy, and I do enjoy just like the pun of them literally drinking Yuri in the second episode, and did lead to its unofficial name in my head at least, which is Yuri Rocks. that in itself does lead me to a question, Ben. You sort of imagined a theoretical sequel where we'd meet a grad student, Nagi, washed up after
burnt
just
out.
Down on the luck, and just spend more time with people in a sort of university setting. I'm wondering if like this is a show which theoretically is a show set at university, and yet it feels like, frankly, university is just an excuse for single-sex university housing to capture a group of girls in a common room to drink together and flirt, rather than anything about where their lives are going or any sort of progression in it. It is of a moment. It obviously slice of life. The genre tells you that's what you're getting. You're getting a slice of their life. You're not getting a progression of it. But do you feel like there is an absence there? It is all just set dressing for this, a show about cute girls flirting with each other.
I mean, sure. It's so interesting that high school anime, most of the action happens in classrooms. But in college anime, most of the action happens in dorm rooms. I think Genshiken is probably the most like actually happening at a university anime. Like, even Golden Time, like most of the conversations happen like in the cafeteria or walking between classes. And then like... the actual courses barely exist. So I'm kind of fine with college being that kind of negative space. Appropriately, since we're mentioning Ruri Rocks, our friend who wrote in also talked about how Nagi's appearance and her career are fantastical in a way that it's not always acknowledged. But I have to accept that, like, Well, I'm getting what I expected out of Botan and a little bit more on the side. And I would like to see them in class. Maybe it's a little bit alcoholic-y, but I would like to see them in class thinking about like what they're going to go out and have for a drink later, because that's kind of how the show works. Is just like the show is so much about characters playing to get closer by playing to have a drink together. And that can happen in many different ways. We already had kind of that with that one scenic view, and we found out that one of the people didn't go because like she couldn't ride on the back of the motorcycle. It was like a whole thing. But yeah, I don't know. I'm just talking in circles. I like it. It's soft. I like the loose, jittery line work. I like a lot about this.
I think you might enjoy Botan that actually, Andy.
Yeah, I'm going to check it out. I just never heard of it.
Busy, busy, busy.
Yeah, Duncan, what is your anime? Have we done them all?
No, we have Awajima.
Yeah.
100 scenes from Awajima.
So, like, I really enjoyed Botan and like, its focus on the immediacy of two people's reactions to each other. Its art style really plays into that with like, the freshness and, like, the looseness of its lines. I think we're really lucky this season that there's a lot of shows with a lot of confidence about their art styles. 100 scenes of Awajima is what I expected to be a fairly typical setup for a Yuri melodrama. It's set in a sort of a select performance school for girls. And so we have young girls in the bloom of youth, separated from any male distractions. It's sort of very classical, soft Yuri setup, all done in a very soft, almost pencil and watercolor style.
Mm-hmm.
That as a first impression, I thought, oh yeah, episode one seems solid. I like its style. I like its sort of languid nature. And then along comes episode two, and it's like, hey, we're doing this across multiple generations, yo.
Mm-hmm.
Its commitment to the idea that this is a cast split over multiple generations where you have a trauma seeded in two people's lives, which then sort of becomes embedded in those around each other and slowly worms its way into almost the mythology of an institution, is mm-hmm. a very unique setup within which to place these stories. And for this to be sort of anchored in this place, in Awajima, and what it represents to these people is saying quite special, feels like, given it being too pretentious, but it does feel quite special.
It's rare. It's rare, at least, I would say.
Hmm.
I do think, like, because the joke, the immediate joke that me, the mocker, Sauron to the glory of Iluvatar, I said Kageki Shoujo, but make it Scum's Wish, and I didn't realize how true that was. Where we do just daisy chain, like we meet someone, I wouldn't say even antagonist, their antithesis, and then the next story is them and their antithesis, and then the next story is that antithesis and their antithesis, and watching us just jump across generations as we like we meet a new character who's just ruining our current character's life, and the question is why the fuck are they like that? And then the next segment is like, here's that character, and here's the person who made them like that, and then here's that character. I like it. It's experimental in a way that I have the immediate like reactionary impulse of like, well, I'm not going to get to know these characters if every half episode we're jumping to a new person and the fucked up shit they've had to deal with surrounding this highly competitive dramatic school. But I like it because, yeah, like you said, I calling it special can have different valences, but it is rare. We don't usually have these non-traditional narratives where there aren't really a protagonist or an antagonist. It's just an endless story of people running into people. It's like if we had Journal with Witch, and we meet the main person, and we meet her, and then we meet her mother, and then we meet her mother's mother, and then we just hop around. I have met several characters that I wish I could spend more time with, but I appreciate that we're just going to rip through this drama school and like find out why this one teacher is like feared as a bitter old bitch.
Oh yeah,
and it's because her grandmother was awful.
Is there not the chance, though, that they could just come back to those characters after?
I think it'd be cool if they complete the loop.
But is there a definite feeling that they're just going to move
so,
on?
So one thing with the title is it uses, like, there's the Hyakunin Ishu, which is the 100 authors, 100 poems, which is, like, the foundational text of Japanese poetry and the basis of Hanafuda, or Karuta. But they use similar language. It's, like, 100 scenes from Awajima is the literal... is the literal story. And so the idea that it's like this, it's like a poetry collection of all these like young women and their imperfect, painful dreams. So it would be cool if we completed the circle and we run back into the main girl who seems like kind of a hapless victim when we meet her the first time.
It does feel like they're using Wakana as kind of an anchor to the other stories, and we are sort of dipping in and out. But it, as Ben says, that chain of time does appear to be what it's going for. I love the writing in it. It has,
yes, sharp.
Sharp when it needs to be sharp when it needs to be sharp, and soft when it needs to be soft. Obviously, like Ibuki's story, the teacher whose grandmother
destroys her granddaughter's life because she's still mad that her daughter was not born pretty.
Yeah,
in a very specific way.
Yeah,
and that's savage.
It's a rough episode. It's like. Two people who just...
The line, if I choose to believe that one can find happiness in life by destroying another's, then I'd have to accept the way my grandmother lived was valid.
Yes.
Just the utter rejection of someone, just this utter rejection of her existence.
Yeah, like just her line ends with me is kind of the message of it. It's powerful. Yeah. And it's funny because we encounter that woman as the older version of the girl who just destroyed someone's dream, just like deleted it into nothingness. And then we come in ready to hate her and discover that she's just got some sort of rot at the heart of her. And no, she's dealing with trauma. And as we meet her in the present day, she's kind of won against it, at least in a small way. It's great. Like I said, I wouldn't want every show to be like this, but these kind of nested stories, a short story collection, but for anime, and using the like the chainedness of human interactions to power it.
Yeah, it is genuinely narratively different, I think the author, she did Ayohana. She is someone who is someone very confident in what she's doing. I feel like there's a lot of confidence in the anime industry these days. I feel like we are getting a wider variety of styles and narratives as a result of it, which is a great thing. Like, you can have literally two shows directed by the same person within one season and people giving very different reactions to Witch Hat Atelier and Akane Banashe.
Yeah. I'm sad that Witch Hat Atelier is going to be our villain this season, but I'm speaking of bored. I'm so bored of it.
I'm really done with that kind of with Witch Hat. It's like
Ninja Headband Atelier.
I just think it's got its direction is great. I think it has this ability to sort of like.
See, I don't think it is great.
Andy's got problems with the direction. Yeah. We talked about it.
I mean, your problem with direction is a problem with the source material. It's that they lifted something directly from the source material and you didn't like it. And the problem is that's the source material. And I agree, it was bad.
But I think let the source material be a source material and let the anime be set the anime. Like, I think its biggest problem is that it is trying to hark back too much the manga. Even if you just like Google Witch Hat Atelier manga, you can see that it is an almost fruitless effort to try and replicate.
But they don't. Like they there's literally one shot which is shot for shot.
There's not. There's so many shots in which they tried. Like they tried to do it with the dragon, didn't really work. They tried to do it with the when they explained the world with when it's like a big circle, when they just like took that central image from the background of that picture, trying too hard to point at things and be like, remember this scene, this shot from the manga. Like even when they try and do that weird thing where they put borders around all the characters when they're introduced, it's like
I like that. I don't know.
It's all,
and maybe it's just the first episode or so that, like,
how many episodes have you got in?
Like, I'm up to date. Okay. So, like, it does feel like they've strayed away from it, which is good.
Well, I was going to say, then, like, how you can actually think that the episode in the quote-unquote hills was anything which could come from a, could be displayed on the page in the same way with the way they use the camera, with them sort of...
Yeah, but again, this then jumps into my second problem, which is it's not consistent. Like, yes, there are some very expensive money shots that are coming up in that anime, but I know that it's going to happen just purely because of the way that the character's face is like 10 times more detailed than when it's out. They have this weird, like, shiny, like, dull visual, and then there is the anime, the episode, the money shot that they do, and then everything is very finely detailed, intricately animated, and it is beautifully animated. I'm not knocking that. I just feel that it just doesn't, like, especially when you compare it to Frieren, which is unfair.
I mean, frankly, I think it's better than Frieren, so we're very divided on this.
Absolutely wild. You're wild.
I don't think Frieren has personality to it a lot of the time.
All of the characters have incredibly good personalities.
That's characters. That's characters. That's not the show itself. Like the.
Oh, so you mean personality of the show, as in, like,
of the direct, of the way it is shot, of like, so the way we've just described, for instance, Botan, like, that is a show which has personality because of the way it is drawn, because of the way the director has decided to tell that story. Like, that's the show's personality as opposed to the character's personality.
I lack the language to say how I think that Frieren definitely has a sort of, like, ivory and gold glow to it that I really appreciate, and I generally like Witch Hat Atelier's art. I agree with Andy that you can watch, like, the detail and the frame rate like triple every time they're going to have, like, one of their big scenes, and that kind of bugs me. I just like, I don't like the characters, and I don't feel like we're going anywhere. Yeah. I feel like I'm trapped in a series of rooms, yeah, and I want this to feel big and sweeping, and that's what Frieren has that this doesn't have.
I would agree with all those points. Frieren, for me, is a show which is the absolute most competent show I've ever seen. Like, it is incredibly consistent. Like, Andy used that word, consistent. Frieren is incredibly consistent in its animation, which I think you... So I think your criticisms of the unevenness that that's a different show.
I would like a cat in Witch Hat Atelier.
That's just Kiki's, frankly.
I mean, yeah, it's the tube snake, but whatever.
That tube snake.
No, A+. Not since QB have we had that cute of an animal sidekick.
I mean, it's a cute sidekick, but Jesus Christ, does it not deserve to be there?
It's just... Well, now Andy's just choosing violence.
Gentlemen, we are a good 20 years plus above the target audience for this particular story. And therefore...
I'm 30 years above the target audience for this story.
That's why I said at least I'm being kind to our younger members.
Okay, fair. Okay. I'm sorry, everybody.
But I agree with you there. But even on the shows that are, like, traditional shonen slop, like fucking Jujutsu Kaisen, like, this is the anime that is for the person who's never watched anime before.
Yeah, no, very true.
Even then, I would say this is not good as a first anime that you ever watch.
Most people's first anime is shit. Most people's first anime is yeah. What? Is what? Dr. Yeah. Stone? Full Metal Alchemist? Like, who knows? I don't know. Oh, they're all over.
Poor Dr. Stone catch.
How dare you admonish Dr. Stone? I love the new season of Dr. Stone. I'm really excited for it. It's really fucking good.
I have
good.
A friend who's really into it. And but he, there's a bashfulness. There's a like shyness to being into Dr. Stone that I don't think I see in a lot of other like big.
It's because it's so.
It's like when John was watching Fire Force, and he was just so sheepish that he was watching Fire Force.
Well, I don't know. We could get into Doctor Stone in another episode. We're not talking about Doctor Stone. We're talking about Witch Hat Atelier, yeah. If this is your first anime, then I can see why you'd like it. I feel like it's gotten a lot of favor from the people who have read the manga, and everyone who's read the manga has been like, it's great, like, it's anime, it's beautiful, and I feel that it is
it is a thing that I should have read instead of watched, because I'm watching it now and I'm not.
I don't think they have much relation to each other. In like, it's such like what the manga is praised for is that it is a manga which can only be a manga, and I know that's a really. But it's not helpful to our audience in describing it.
But what, like I say, like when you just Google like Witch Hat Atelier manga pictures, and it is art and it's gorgeous.
It takes something which only exists on the page, and it uses that element. It uses the way panels work. It breaks panels. It uses the way lines move, and those become its medium. And so I have read some of the manga, and what I like about the show, and what is probably the key to me feeling very favourable towards it in a way which you two obviously do not, is that it has this technique which it uses recurring, which is it uses the camera to guide your attention. Like, we first see it when we meet Coco and she's like cutting a piece of cloth for Quiffery. We see her sort of like pull the sort of like inkstone towards her, and we see her then push it towards the camera to bring a cut to Quiffery's face. Mm-hmm. It is using the camera instead of a line. In the manga, you'd be using a panel to push to another, morphing into another panel or snaking down a page. And in here, it's using the camera as a proxy for that.
It's a good observation.
It knows it can't move within a page, so it's moving your focus within the image. And in the Heights episode, which is the third one where they're flying, I think you particularly see that, where it's drawing you up and it's pushing you down, and the camera leads the action. Like, the camera will just start to move up a moment before the actual characters do, and it's really wonderful to see them try and translate something rather than replicate. And the moments it falls flat are the moments when it tries to replicate. It's, you pointed out one, which is the portal, Quiffery's just shown Coco like this really scary place where she might have to go eventually, and then he's like, oh, this is like the scary side of magic, but magic can be nice too. And then it cuts to it, like the portal shows a big field of flowers and they're outlined in light. It's just a one-to-one of the panel, and it just felt generic. And that panel is kind of generic in itself. Like, I think there's a little bit of revisionism about the early volumes of Witch Hat Atelier. As the illustrator became more confident, it became more experimental. And so I think people treating the work as a whole like it's this amazingly experimental, and where it's something which grew into that. And the fact that some of that essence has been brought to this early one is something I look on very favourable. That it hasn't been 100% success, but even that they're succeeding in parts by doing something unique to the screen, just as Witch Hat was unique to the page. That to me is.
But I don't. Apart from that, like, I just don't think it is being unique to the screen. And I appreciate what you're picking up, which admittedly I didn't pick up. But I don't think it's being unique. And I think that's the problem. I think it should try and be more experimental, but it doesn't have, like, be it mixed media, be it like so many other things that we have seen in other anime that try and make a creative effort to be different.
Anime as a whole, as a legacy of its days on Cell, has tended not to have movement. So the things that the show I actually have loved visually the most season is something with the extremely generic title, Agents of the Four Seasons, Dance of Spring. Now, I went into this thinking it was basically going to be a fairly standard action shonen. It is not that at all. Its story is written by the creator of Violet Evergarden, which, as you guys know, mm-hmm. is not a story I am particularly fond of in any way, shape, or form.
Which is wild, because it's great.
I have absolutely loved this because I recently got a new camera, and this is a show which, unlike pretty much everything I've seen for a long time, doesn't just give you a sort of viewpoint in the screen. It gives you a viewpoint through a lens. Mm. It is shot with a level of artifice where everything is seen through with the qualities of a physical lens. Perhaps the most obvious ones is like chromatic aberrations, which is where an image will often have like an outline of a secondary color where stuff is being refracted from it. And so it also uses this idea of bokeh, which is the way images out of focus become sort of distorted by a lens. The thing it uses ubiquitously is depth of field. So you will have, normally in an anime, you will have a sharp foreground and a blurred background. But what this does is you will have, just as with the human eye, you will have an area of focus and then it becomes progressively more blurred around that. So you will see a character's face and the central area of that face will be perfectly sharp. And as you draw back the hair, the shoulders or whatever of her will be blurred. It's depth of field. It's something which a lot of photography has become about exaggerating. That was always something which was very difficult for animation to do, because you have a cell and you have a cell behind it. And when you photograph those two, you they're both sharp. They're both in focus. Disney actually were one of the first companies to find a way around this. They had this something called multiplanar cameras. They invented it to deal with backgrounds. It also allowed them, when they wanted to have one part of an image in focus and another part out of focus. You have this really flat, very graphic style to most animation. This is something which can only really be done with modern technology. And I really appreciate that the show for making that attempt to do something which hadn't been accessible to the medium before, to see what that choice is gives its direct. I feel like when I watch that and I see it trying to do something different, and I go back to Witch Hat and I see the way it tries to use a camera moving to direct our view and to influence us, like that feels to me like it is making an attempt to do something which is just unique to the capabilities of anime as it is right now. Not looking back, not trying to actually... Let's shit on Trigun again. Not trying to force a narrative into a CGI show, so everything has to be done, set out like a level in a video game. I don't know. It's the fact that it's trying something, whether it succeeds or not, is important to me. And maybe that's just me just being...
Yeah, I'm afraid me. I'm a writing guy. Like, I'm a writing guy, and like the idea that Coco is special, but there's nothing special about her, and that she's got this new adoptive parent who is just endlessly negligent.
Insanely negligent. and then the forced contrivance of the Naruto, like, says friendship, hateship between her and that other woman.
If I was in charge of some wizard students and one of them tried to kill the other, I would do more than just be like, hey, you okay? I know sometimes people try to kill you.
Yeah, sorry. That will happen from time to time now you're a witch. Oh, by the way, everything's really good. Like, there's nothing to worry about. Like, it's all actually really good and there's no problems apart from the known bad entity that exists in this world.
They're probably not going to come back, though. They're probably not going to come for you.
No. They just gave you a massive book and you killed your mum because of it. But that chapter
of your life is closed. You're a wizard.
Yeah, now. Yeah, exactly. You're with me now.
Voldemort's wizard not going to come kill you, Harry. Voldemort's not going to come kill you.
Wizard Gojo, who I fucking hate his design.
Wizard Kakashi? I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about.
No, that's Ninja Gojo is Wizard Ninja Kakashi.
Oh, I heard Legos. That people like those Legos, yeah. It's fine. Whatever.
It's just, I was just expecting more. Like, and I feel that the story is not unique. The characters are not unique. The setting's not unique. There's nothing very unique about this show.
I cannot speak to the full extent of the story, but the art definitely starts more conventional and becomes less conventional. So maybe people are back projecting with a story which becomes more interesting and less conventional as it goes along.
Which is what I'm hoping with Akane Banashee, by the way, bringing that back. Mm. Like, I'm hoping that it gets to the stuff that is interesting.
Mm.
It's just a slow start.
Maybe Witch Hat enjoyers would watch the anime and say the same. Oh, this is just the conventional. This is the setup. When it gets to the good stuff, but who knows?
I mean, maybe we'll find out in a couple of months' time.
We'll find out.
Is this the Final Fantasy of anime? You'll appreciate this in 50 episodes' time. Don't worry. It's you'll see. It was all a build up.
I'm not appreciating it now, so I'm not enjoying it. Like this is the problem. This is why I don't play. I can't like Final Fantasy games, is because I fucking give up, because I get so bored. Yeah. Like, I don't give a shit about the Shinra government. Just get me off. Give me something fucking interesting to do. It's the same with fucking Witch Hat Atelier, man. Like, there's.
They got teleported to a null space with a dragon in it, yeah. So maybe they'll die.
At least when they got teleported to a strange empty city with a dragon in it in Delicious in Dungeon, they tried to eat the dragon later, and sustainable.
Also, whilst I don't disagree that like the manga does get more experimental, I do wonder how much of that is because of its previous form of being an experimentally beautiful manga. Like,
maybe we'll have to see. We'll have to see.
I mean, but that's true of everything. That's true of any story. It's like, famously, like, so many shonen authors hate their heroes by the end of their thing because people are always expecting certain things of them, and they're like, oh fuck, I'm so tired of this fucker, I just want to kill him off. But no one my editor will not let me kill him off.
Witch Hat Atelier, man, it's just not doing it for me. And maybe it'll get better. I'm hoping it'll get better. But right now, to quote Mariah Carey, it ain't impressing me much. No? No? Okay, fine. Fuck you.
All right, let's wrap this up. Well, next time, since we've been talking about how, like, Delicious in Dungeon, Frieren, Witch Hat Atelier is kind of moving back towards an old school anime fantasy as opposed to having to go through the isekai lit RPG sort of lens. Let's go ahead and talk about our favorite fantasy anime next time. And in the meantime, rate, review, and subscribe to us on the podcast platform of your choice. Find us on Facebook, Keyframes Podcast. Find us on Blue Sky, Keyframes Pod. Email us questions, keyframespodcast@gmail.com. Or just comment on our website, keyframespodcast.com. And most of all, tell a friend.
But tell a friend who is unexpectedly as, like, really energetic, like, exit when everyone else is really sad. And on that note.
Or tell a friend who's been replaced by a clone who is more socially viable and much more beloved.
Tell a friend, all I want for Christmas is you. That's the only Mariah Carey I could find. And that's all that's fucking all I know her for. That's it.
Sad dejected goodbyes, otherwise my bed is dead.
Everyone say goodbye, Mariah Carey. Goodbye, Mariah Carey.
Goodbye,
Mariah.
Goodbye, Mariah.
Rest in peace. She left so young.
Andy, you're gonna get us canceled. We killed Mariah Carey.